Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Britain and spent her early years in South Africa. She's the author of 12 novels and 2 short story collections. She's been twice longlisted and once shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, has won the IMPAC, now the International Dublin Literary Award, the John Llewellyn Rees and the Hawthornden Prize, and was named one of Granta's 20 Best Young British Writers in 2003. Her latest novel, Happy, won the 2017 Goldsmiths Prize and was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction this year. Nicola Vaca, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
That is such an oppressive array of awards for somebody who says she doesn't have ambition.
No, they throw awards at me, don't they? Just all I care about is the cash. I do. And the impact was a huge amount of money. So that was just the greatest joy. But awards are so, it's all so arbitrary and partial and so I don't take it that seriously. Obviously, I take the check incredibly seriously. As a literary author, you just earn very little money, so it's great to get an award.
Let's go back to where this started, because you were born here in Britain, but in fact you went off to South Africa. Why was that? And has it now, being back, does that sort of heighten your sense of perhaps being a bit of an outsider?
I think it does. My parents emigrated when I was 9. This was in the 70s. I stayed there for 5 or 6 years, and then I returned with my mother. And my sister and my dad stayed in South Africa. So it created a sense of fracture, I suppose. And also, a lot of my early work was set on or around islands. And I now think that was a psychological response from being in a huge continent and feeling it was a pretty terrifying and overwhelming time for me. And then looking back to the UK is a place of safety and containment. Writers are often, there's often a sense of fracture and dislocation. It makes you step back and watch things more carefully. You become more of an observer. And you don't belong particularly. So I went to South Africa and I didn't belong there. And then I returned to England and obviously I still have a slight accent, so I don't entirely belong here. And you don't know where you belong in general. But I think that's a very fruitful thing because you have to interrogate those feelings and find a place for yourself.
So perhaps another thing that made you feel a bit of an outsider or maybe a sense of disconnectedness was you were very ill as a child.
I wasn't. Well, I don't know if I was very ill. I mean, I had pneumonia, bronchial pneumonia as a child, but you know, I wasn't an especially sickly child. I was a fairly sickly teenager and adult. I had a huge number of food allergies and health problems, but I was a very vigorous and irritating child. I mean, like a maddening little wild child, really. And also in South Africa, we didn't have TV. I'd grown up on TV in the UK. And so then to go to a place with no TV was just horrifying and overwhelming. And so obviously I had to go to the library, read a lot and listen to the radio. Would I have been a writer if I'd stayed in the UK? I would have just carried on watching Doctor Who and doing the things normal people do. But yes, so in South Africa, I learned how to read. And yes, that was really important. And also to be bored, which I think is the most important thing. Not to allow yourself, but I think it's important that people are constantly bored. It makes them more creative.
What were you reading that was inspiring you at that time?
Nothing in particular. As a child, just children's books. I remember moving from the children's library to the adult library, that transition, how exciting it was. And it was like jumping over a river or something into adulthood and always just wanting to go into the adult section where my mother was. And then maybe picking up the books with huge writing, you know, for the people with short-sightedness, just because you're like, maybe I can access this complex adult world this way. But no, as a child, I just read pretty much every children's book going.
Then at what point did you realise that actually what you wanted to do was create your own books?
From being very small, words and narrative have been important to me. I remember even as a very small child being given my first exercise book by a teacher and being told to write a story in it and returning the next day and the book was entirely filled. It was just so exciting and liberating for me to have just page after page. I mean, it was probably just, you know, like The Shining, you know, where he just writes the same sentence again and again. It was probably like that. But to me, it felt just wonderful to fill space with language. I never overthink it, even as an adult. I try to maintain that innocence, that kind of connectedness to words and to narrative and to space, and to keep that. I don't overthink it. I try to keep it very simple, my relationship to language. I don't think of myself as someone that loves words, but I presume that I am someone that loves words.
So anybody that's read your most recent book would possibly be laughing out loud at this point, as I'm trying hard not to. Because this has got to be one of the most complex linguistic and textual books.
It's true. I know. How does it happen? I don't know how it happens. I mean, I'm like an imbecile in day-to-day life. So, but when I relate to the page, I suppose a more considered part of me comes to life. But, I mean, you just don't see it in day-to-day life.
Well, look, I think let's talk about the book now, because I think we must explain what it is and how it works. That's an odd way to describe a book, but this is very definitely a book with an internal machine, perhaps. I knew that I was going to love it when I read your note at the very beginning, which recommends a particular musician that we should listen to whilst we read it. And I just thought, how fantastic to even have your playlist sorted.
No, but I've had a lot of questions about that. And I never listen to anything when I'm working. So it's not to be listened to as you're reading. It's to be listened to at the similar time. So I work in complete silence with industrial headphones on. I will not tolerate any noise. So then I became traumatized that people felt, because I say in conjunction with the music of Agustin Berrios. But obviously, yes, the idea of people trying to comprehend this complex text and listening to that sort of slightly scary, jangly guitar music at the same time, it's like a vision of hell.
He was a Paraguayan guitarist. Tell us about him and why he's in Happy.
He's just an extraordinary, complex, romantic figure. And he embraced the guitar, but he was also, how to explain it, he embraced everything that was modern and Western, but he also came from a kind of tribal background. And so he played the guitar, but with metal strings. For a period of time, metal strings were fashionable in the world of guitar playing, but not for very long. And when better types of strings were invented, he persisted in playing with the metal strings and he became a kind of outcast. He was despised. And there are lots of theories as to why he stuck with the metal strings. Nobody really quite knows. But he used to perform he's an amazing composer, but he used to perform originally wearing like a beautiful suit, very European looking. And then at a particular time, he decided to dress up as a tribal elder. And so he performed covered in war paint and feathers with a bare chest, which was just considered outrageous at the time. So he sort of personifies these two worlds that he's inhabited, both comfortably and uncomfortably. The most fascinating thing about him, I found, was that he was one of the very first people, and I can't remember what time this would have been, maybe the 1920s, one of the first people to have plastic surgery simply out of vanity. So he had his top lip reduced so that his native features were Europeanized. So I immediately saw him as this paradoxical figure. Paradox is my great obsession in life and in writing. So the book tries to understand that contradiction between the modern and the ancient, and he represents the complexity of that relationship. And he's an extraordinary musician. Like, his music is exquisite, very moving, very simple. A great composer. And everybody says at the time, and they've said since, that he would have had a huge career if he'd not been as strange and uncompromising.
It's a post-apocalyptic novel.
Yeah.
And that the whole storyline concerning him is just one part of it. Because,
yes,
of course, there is a parallel narrative which is set in the future. It's a future saved from floods, from fires, plagues and all the rest of it by the altruistic powers. So tell us about this world.
Well, it's a perfect world where everyone is eternally young and there's no God in this world. Everything is known. Yes, and everything is run by a system and a graph. And so emotion is calibrated. And yes, everybody is very peaceful and calm. And there is no sex. There's no desire. They're freed from desire. And they live in the moment. So they are living in the perpetual now. And they self-censor, but they also are, everything they do is potentially visible to everybody else. So they're completely open. And my character is called Mira A. She makes guitars and she's a guitar player and a composer. And she lives in this world. But unfortunately, she becomes overwhelmed with a desire to tell a story, which she thinks is the story of herself. She's not sure. This is a breach of all of the codes of the new world and the system.
Because narrative is banned.
Well, nothing is forbidden. Everything is permitted. Everything is permitted because everyone is completely free. So what she's doing is superficially wrong and is disruptive. And she really tries to stop herself doing it. And we don't really know if she's telling her own story. We think, I mean, she's probably just constructing a story out of disparate facts. So to sacrifice everything for nothing, basically, is what she's doing. She exists within perfection. And it's a sort of awful tragedy for her and for the story that she can't contain her desire to speak out.
And it seems to me that you're speaking out the whole way through it. I mean, you're addressing such big themes. The young themselves. I mean, really just a parody of our snowflake generation.
I guess so. I always have an agenda as a writer, but I would never say there's a clear-cut political or not in a lily-livered way. It's hard to explain, but I always have an agenda. But it's not like a lot of people have thought that this book is a satire of lots of things that are, you know, being in the moment, all of these things that are very current. But it's not actually a satire. I'm very sincere about the idea of the perfection of the world I create. I think it does sound like a perfect world. Yes, I believe in those things at some level. So it's not a satire. Unfortunately, the narrative writes me as the author writes itself. And this book was very much like that. You know, it was a very disruptive book for me personally. And often my books write the future of myself. And so it's kind of a hard book to talk about. It was a very, a very chaotic, kind of crazy nervous breakdown book, really. Yeah, so it wasn't a satire. I do think the world I created was a beautiful, perfect world.
Although it descends into a hellish place or a painful place.
Well, it's allowed to because of a lack of control, maybe. Yes. And it's allowed to because of information and how incredibly delicate and dangerous it can be.
The way the book is laid out is extraordinary. And I suppose when I talk about the engine of the book, it's been constructed. The words are in different colours, corresponding, I think, to the graph. You have pages and pages of the same text repeated. Your designer must have been having a heart attack.
No, totally. Well, first of all, my publisher had a heart attack. My editor, Jason, when he realised I was writing a book in colour, I thought he'd be all excited. I was like, I'm writing a book in colour. And to him, it was a catastrophe because it's so expensive to publish in colour. So already the book was going to be immensely expensive. Surprisingly, I'm very controlling about the layout of my books and how they're justified because I write in my own particular way. It's unjustified, so it doesn't conform to the traditional layout of pages. Early on, the sub-editors and everyone else would correct what I did wrong. And then I would see the finished copy or the revised version. I would feel horror because it didn't represent my vision of the words on the page, which is very particular. A few years into my publishing career, one of my editors said, oh, we'll just publish it exactly as it's written. And I think, I can't remember from how early on, Behindlings, one of my early big novels, was published as I'd written it, to the extent that they even used the same font. And I was horrified when I saw it, because I always choose a different font for each book, just randomly. So I was horrified when I saw the book in this terrible font. But they copied it so absolutely. And since then, I've had really great editors and they've all written the text as I write it. But with this book, because it was so heavily designed, I worked with My sister is a graphic artist, so she did most of the graphics in the book. And I also worked with a designer. So I had the finished text, and then she obviously took it and designed it. And then all hell broke loose because the text was completely transformed, because design is about fashion and style. And all of my fonts had to be changed because there were only particular ones that were available. I'd used an old computer, and there were just all of these dramas. I had to have the book on the page as it was written, because for me, the flow of words and the gaps on the page and between words are very meaningful. And at some level, much of my career is about shaping words around space and around concepts that are difficult to understand. That's how I understand them. So space and layout is really vital to me.
Tell me about the A in parenthesis and the whole disambiguation.
Okay, so the book is, I pronounce the book H-A-P-P-Y. That's how I don't pronounce it happy. So for me, it's H-A-P-P-Y. And I always go A in brackets. It's like the clumsiest way to have to talk about a book. But so I call it H-A-P-P-Y. And that's because it reminds me of the song that I remember from a hospital comedy called Only When I Laugh. And the theme tune was, I'm H-A-P-P-Y, but sang in a really sad voice. So that's how the book is called that. It's H-A-P-P-Y. So it's sort of tuneful and sad.
I love that even the title is musical.
It's music, but also contentious. So the word is written in capitals because whenever Mira A uses the word happy, it comes up in capital letters with the A in brackets and red. And it's the very first sign that something is going wrong with her. There's a dissonance. So that's why the word is important. I suppose it's important with regard to the text, but it's kind of a blip and a problem within the text and within her, the way she's speaking and presenting herself. So, yes, and in the book, colour represents emotion. So if the text pinkens and purples, that means you're violating a code within the world of the young. So the A is in brackets and in red, which immediately signals to the young, signals a problem. And yes, so Mira A has this problem. And it's some tiny little fault in her, within her perfection, that the system has to somehow contain. And it is a tiny vibration that she has, which is what sets the whole narrative off. And it's connected to the nature of sound and resonance, and it's to do with her own history. So that's what that word represents in the text.
Mm-hmm. And her own history and her own future, because she then, her world changes, or does it change?
She changes her world. She makes those choices, doesn't she, to change her world. She can't control. It's sort of meaningful and meaningless at the same time. And so, yes, she becomes engulfed by language and by the idea of growth and, yes, by the idea of faith, I suppose, at some point. All of these concepts that are completely forbidden.
The graph flashes when she uses certain words, and she's worried about getting an EOE, an excess of emotion.
Yes. Nobody wants one of those. No one wants too much emotion. So she just has to stay calm. Yes, but she doesn't. She doesn't. She gets overexcited. And as soon as she has one of those, the graph alerts everybody else, all of the other people who are around her in her community, and they all see that a violation of the graph has taken place, and it's a very sad thing for them. And it's an awful thing for her. She has let herself and her whole community down, and they are, you know, she loves her community.
We keep going back to music and vibration, and her mantra, of course, the tuning fork is in my heart.
Yes. Now I'm trying to remember why on earth I came up with that. Yes, well, there's basically a whole storyline which now terrifies me because I'm so far from having written the book, but it's to do with the nature of music and recording. There are two types. There's a kind of war, isn't there, in tuning. So, and we live according to a particular, there's just intonation, and then there's 12-tone equal temperament, which is how all of our music is tuned. But the original form of tuning that we used was just intonation. And so there's a sort of sub-theme in the book that we are living discordantly. And so the modern type of tuning was just more convenient and it just works. But the system according to which Mireille lives, I think, is tuned slightly incorrectly. And that eventually this is what's going to generate complete insanity in the text. It's this division. And so the tuning fork, there's lots of stuff going on where she's tuning choruses and tuning guitars. And there's just a particular type of tuning. And there's the vibration that's in her head, which is to do with things not quite functioning. And that whole thing, yes, sort of becomes a big drama.
It's a drama to read, too. But what must it have been to write?
I write two types of novels. I write very big books, which are boring to write and very painstaking and heavily researched. And I write, so I would have written Dark Man's or Behindlings. They're big books and they drag those out of you over many years. And then I write little books, which are sort of manic books, and they take 3 to 6 months, maybe 8 months. And this is one of those little books. So I was in the middle of writing a really big book and I interrupted it. I think I interrupted it twice. I interrupted it for a book called The Cauliflower, which is about Sri Ramakrishna, the great Hindu mystic. So, and that's already quite an outrageous book. And so I interrupted it for that. And then I was about to return to it. And I just finished the Ramakrishna book, which was very exhausting because it involved huge amounts of very quick research. Like huge amounts of notes and returning to pages, and like, oh, it was just a nightmare. So I just finished that and then I started writing this book just randomly one day. I was already really exhausted from the Ramakrishna book, and so this book was a demanding book, and I stopped sleeping when I wrote it. I didn't sleep for 10 months, and I would have at best 1 or 2 hours sleep a night. So it really was a kind of manic interlude and not something I even enjoy thinking or talking about, actually, but not unhappy, like perfect. I was perfectly cheerful, but it was just an enormous wave of energy and there was no rest until it was done.
And do you feel that you are perhaps becoming a channel for something, that creativity is coming to you from somewhere, or is it self-generated?
I always think that. I always think it. Something just passes through you. I think it's complex. It's very complex. For me, it's like the book writes you. So it's the relationship between your conscious and your unconscious. And so the unconscious in my literary, I'm divided between a really well-behaved, law-abiding person and a really terrible, uncontrolled person. I've always been that way. Even when I was very small, I wanted to be a nun and a go-go dancer. Those were my ambitions, like as a very small girl. That was like, because I used to watch Top of the Pops and I wanted to be one of Pan's people. But I also wanted to be a nun. That has never changed. So there's that contradiction in me. Yes, I have to live with those two urges, which really can't be combined. But my creative life is ungovernable. It is uncontrolled and it is utterly free. And yes, this book represented that in its most extreme form. Yes, so now there has been a retreat, like emotionally and psychologically, from the text. There would have to be. I don't think I could go further than this.
Yeah. To live at that intensity, I mean.
Yes. Magnificent and dreadful, but also very destructive for everyone around me. You know, other people paid the price for the book. So the book writes you sometimes and you have to live with the consequences of it and accept them. But you know, sometimes it's sad, but also it's just what has to be. That's creativity, really.
Mm. You talked about cauliflower. I know that that previously you've written about hijab-wearing women. And I wondered about you and faith, particularly if you're talking about perhaps creativity coming from another place. You're a Catholic.
I am a Catholic, a very devout Catholic. I'm a convert, so I haven't always been a Catholic. It was a very complex journey for me. I did transcendental meditation for many years, which I thoroughly recommend to anyone that's a writer or an artist, or it's a very fruitful practice, a very creative practice. But I had a very powerful urge when I was meditating to chant with beads. So I initially bought japa mala beads, which are kind of Indian chanting beads.
And eventually, after a period of time, it wasn't enough. And I realised that what I wanted to be doing was the rosary, which is a Catholic bead kind of chanting rituals. And it was something that I didn't want to be a Catholic. I'm liberal-minded and it just seemed a huge journey to have to transition into a completely different way of being, really. I didn't have any choice. I became a Catholic. I am a Catholic, and it's a beautiful, sustaining faith for me. But I'm not sure, once again, I'm not sure my work is more very spiritual. It's not a word I enjoy. Maybe the last four books have been very spiritual, but a lot of people read my work as having always been spiritual. People have read The Cauliflower and thought that it was just a satire, which at some level it is, at some level. So within me is the paradox of faith and unfaith. It just depends which part of me, I suppose, is ascendant.
In HAPPY, you're experimenting. And I wonder what that experiment has taught you.
What has it taught me? I don't know if I ever learn anything. I learn something at the moment that I'm writing. There's a lot of laughter and there's always mischief. Writing the short books is very joyous, so there's a lot of laughter and mischief, but I don't know if I've come away knowing anything more. I think everything I know is contained within the text and then exists there, and I move on in a sort of airheaded way somewhere else. It's quite hard to explain, but innocence is so important to me as a writer. It's what sustains me, and I'm not considered, and I try not to talk about the work too much or think about the process, or so I tend to avoid all of that. So there's a kind of cut-off and a kind of wooliness, unfortunately, which makes me really irritating. Like, yes, no, that's just how it is. I do remain childlike when I relate to texts and ideas. Complexity comes, but it's not intended. It's not considered. And always, if I have a choice when I'm sitting typing, if I have a choice to make like a silly joke or to try and say something serious, I'll always be silly. I mean, my work is very silly in general, but I'm considered really quite serious. So it's a weird paradox.
Where do you go after this in a book that has essentially destroyed narrative?
I'm so glad you said that, because that's how I saw it. When I finished the book, I thought, wow, you've just killed it. You've killed the novel for yourself. That's it. I mean, I can't say I've killed it for everyone. To me, I had killed the form. I'd killed it. And I thought, well, that's it. I've destroyed the thing that sustains me and that I earn a living from and that I love. I just felt joyful about it. I just thought it was funny. And also, because I celebrate the idea of paradox, I realised that the contradiction allowed me to go forward, so I could destroy something and from destruction could come creation. And also The Cauliflower was about celebrating the goddess Kali, and she is the goddess of creation and destruction. And I think the two are totally intertwined. And so from destruction, creation comes. That's how I see the world, and that's how the world is. So from the destruction of this text, I hope creativity will come.
So do I, because I cannot wait to read what you write next.
Thank you.
Nicola Barker, thank you so much for being on Meet the Writers. HAPPY is by Nicola Barker. It's published by William Heinemann and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and Stephanie Saikia. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. Thank you for listening.